The Centre for Stories is a place where stories are told, shared, and kept. This recording is from Home Currents, an event held on the 19th of February 2019 in partnership with the Perth Festival for Perth Writers Week 2019. It features emerging writers Priya Callan, Rehanati A. Jalil, and Rachelle De Cruz in conversation with Sasanke Masimang.
There are a significant number of refugees and asylum seekers in this country, but there is also a significant migrant population, and you three represent that migrant population. So I always laugh because there's this assumption, like if a Swedish person comes to Australia, people assume that they settled here. But if one of us comes here, you assume that we fled here, right? So can you tell us a little bit about your families and how you settled here rather than fled here? Tell us about your upbringing, your parents, your siblings. Like, what brought you here? And I'll start with you in the middle, Priya.
So I guess I probably didn't have as much choice in why I came here. So my parents are from Punjab, which is a state in the north, and sort of my grandfather actually used to sort of work in Australia. He worked on the train line, and so then as a result he brought sort of my mum and her siblings over, and then my parents sort of got married here and then had me and my siblings. So I think for me it's always been going back to India, you have a sort of a slightly different relationship because you've been sort of brought up here, and I haven't really had the experience of actually, I guess, living there. And it's sort of you go back more like as a visitor. But over the time, even the population or just the community of Punjabis or sort of that sort of community of Indians here has grown. So you do get like a bit more of a sense of sort of that piece of, I guess, India, that piece of your home being here as well.
So lots of back and forth for you as a kid growing up?
Yeah, so I think when we were kids, we used to sort of go, spend a couple of months at a time. Obviously, then you don't have as much of a choice in when you're going on holiday. And then slowly, as you get older, you kind of, stop going, this more by choice.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I think I probably started, being a lot more interested in my heritage and India as well. I've sort of recently sort of started sort of practicing a lot of yoga, started practicing a lot of meditation. And so I've been, reading a lot of the texts as well and just sort of learning more about the culture from that perspective. And I think it's been sort of a really different angle rather than when you're growing up. It's just sort of what's happening in the community or what your parents have.
What your parents are dragging you to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Michelle?
I grew up in Malaysia, and I moved here when I was 8 or 9, with my mom, my dad, my brother, and my sister. But I'm Indian, but my parents were both born in Malaysia as well, so we don't have that connection to India in the same way that Priya has. We have more of a connection to, Malaysian culture. Mm. Or even Singaporean culture, which is quite similar as well.
Okay.
I remember my mom, dad, and I went to go watch Crazy Rich Asians last year. It was amazing because that's how people, that's the way that we talk. That's the way that we eat our food, it's all
so
the same. So yeah, it was really cool. So I guess there's a little bit of a disconnect with the way that I have to sort of engage with Indian culture. Am I supposed to be engaging with my Malaysian side or my Indian side? We moved to rural Australia as well.
Kalgoorlie?
Yeah, not a lot of Malaysians in Kalgoorlie. So that was, it had its own trials, it had its own issues in that town. It's a small country town, which anywhere in the world you're going to get that sort of deep-seated racism as well and those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, I do attribute one thing to Kalgoorlie, which I'm very much proud of, and I can say that I'm happy that I managed to get that experience, which was to be able to experience the Aboriginal community there, because it's quite different from the Aboriginal community in Perth, and I know a lot of people that grow up in Perth don't have that same sort of interaction. But the reason we came to Australia is because my mom got a job in a school called CAPS in Coolgardie, which is Christian Aboriginal Parent Directed Schools. So my mom taught Aboriginal students for 4 years.
Mm.
And for a term I was going to that school as well. So we were very much immersed in the culture there.
Very interesting.
So yeah, it was rural Australia is rough, but it's okay.
And yourself?
So I was born in Malaysia, mm-hmm. but both my parents are from Banda Aceh in Indonesia. But I moved to Australia when I was about 2.5. So when it comes to, for example, language, I often say to people, I know enough Malay and Indonesian to converse with a 3-year-old. That's about it. But also,
and hope that the 3-year-old is not very chatty.
There was a period where, like, for example, just with language, because I my first language technically is Malay, but Indonesian is slightly different. There are lots of similarities, mm. but so in my head, I can generally understand both,
yeah.
But sometimes I don't know which is which. I just
intuitively.
That's right. I'm like, oh, and it's usually when I speak to, like, when I attempt to speak to cousins or, and I say something, they look at me confused. I'm like, okay, that must be Malay. but I guess, just pretty much I have very much grown up here. And I remember actually when I was doing my citizenship interview, it wasn't until much later that I decided to become a citizen, and I remember the lady saying to me, "You've got more of an Australian accent than I do." So that's, I guess, a bit about my background. But as for how it came to be here, my father, he's a minister of religion, I suppose, and he got a job in Perth. Mm-hmm. So where he was originally working in Malaysia, but once he got a job here, that's how we actually came to move here.
Right. And how much back and forth has there been in your life between home?
Not enough.
Right.
Definitely not enough. Like in the last 30 odd years, like less than 5 times, I'd say. So not enough.
Yeah. Mm. So at the moment in Australia, there's lots of rich and interesting and I think important conversations about who is Australian, what it means to be Australian. All three of you are Australian citizens, correct? And you chose to become a citizen as an adult?
Adult, yes.
Okay, that's interesting. And you?
No, because my parents became citizens, so I
so it was
citizen,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, and of course, Priya, you were born here, and so you're second generation, actually.
Yeah.
Second generation Australian.
My parents were both born
in India.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so one of the questions I have is about this idea of being both inside of the insider Australian, like really. Especially for you two, having grown up here and having Aussie accents and having Australian friends, and this is your life.
Mm-hmm.
How much of an insider versus an outsider have you felt? Did you feel growing up, and do you feel now? Is it an easy, kind of seamless relationship with the wider Australian mainstream culture, whatever that means,
mm-hmm.
Or is it complicated and requires some navigation? Whoever wants to go.
I think for me, I probably feel a lot more like an insider. My schooling, I think, really contributed to this. So the high school that I went to was really, really ethnically diverse. So you felt so comfortable with the fact that you had all these sort of different cultures, because everybody else was also the
mm-hmm.
same. They also were from so many different sort of backgrounds. Their parents were often migrants as well. And so it didn't really feel like that you weren't Australian because of having that.
Yeah.
So I think because growing up in that kind of environment and having your friends like that, and obviously in high school, there's sort of your formative years, that's when you're sort
yeah.
of really kind of experimenting, or you're really unsure of yourself. So to kind of be in that environment with those people was, I think, quite nurturing. And you know, once you get out into the workforce, university, you're a little bit more sure of yourself anyway.
Yeah.
So I think having that base and being like, oh, it was okay that I came, I have a different background, or that, you know, I eat different food at home, or my parents speak a different language, it didn't really feel like it was. And so once you sort of go into university or in work, you kind of just carry that with you,
that sort of confidence and being accepted.
Yeah.
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 With myself, I think also schooling did contribute a bit to not feeling different, as really, I guess, per se. Like throughout my life, I went to different Islamic schools or Muslim schools. But I do remember when I was, I think it was when I was going to go to high school, my parents did ask me, did I want to go to a public school or do I want to go to a high school that's a Muslim high school? And I remember deciding to, I guess, stay within my comfort zone and go to a Muslim school, especially because like I just made the decision to wear the hijab, I guess, full time. And I was concerned about possible reactions if I were to go to a public school at that period in time. But, you know, I did university, like just at UWA, so by that stage, I guess I'd maybe grown more in confidence. So it's kind of this thing of, I maybe a big part of my life felt like not really an outsider per se, but I've been in my comfort zone, but in uni, still feeling, still connecting with people who I, you know, share values with and who are of all different cultures, faiths, backgrounds.
Interesting.
I feel like definitely I can say outsider in that regard. Maybe because in Kalgoorlie, as a guy, you kind of have two options on the social route. You either play sport or you play video games. And I was trash at both. I really enjoyed music.
Yeah.
And I never listened to rap before I came to Australia. And I was like, for like a 9-year-old, I was like, whoa, what is this? This is amazing.
Yeah.
And so then I also had like two sort of groups of friends. I had my white Australian friends. And then I also had my African friends who are from like Zimbabwe, Mozambique.
There's a big mining sort of, there's lots of engineers who...
Yeah, so like most of their dads would all be, especially my African friends, most of their dads are in the field of mining.
I've heard of that.
But then the thing about that is I'm not African either, so if they start speaking,
I
can't understand and I can't relate with them.
You should have learned Shona.
I was young at the time. I couldn't, you know, I didn't relate to the sports people. I tried to do the video game thing for a while, but it just didn't work out, I guess. And then, so I moved to Perth 2 years ago and I graduated high school. And Perth has been a lot better because obviously it's more diverse, you know, going to uni, being able to be around people who write. I mean, like, most of my friends haven't read a book in like 10 years as well, so it's like...
We're going to get to this. We're going to talk about this. We need to talk about this.
Okay,
The millennials. I'm sorry. So far away from being millennial.
I just want to clear that up. My friends from Perth have read books. My friends from rural Australia haven't read.
Okay.
Which is
interesting because you would assume it would be the opposite, that there would just be less to do in a country town, and so you'd read more.
That's true. But I guess like the culture side of Perth is what pushes people into the arts, into reading, writing, music, and all sorts of those sorts of things. So like since coming to Perth, for sure, it's been cool. I still don't feel like that insider. I still don't feel like accepted yet. But I guess that's because of the past, you know, like 10 years of feeling on the outside.
Right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your writing. So if we think about all of your different experiences and how you've grown up, very much for you two, certainly very much accepted. You sort of in between stools, but in some ways obviously very accepted. It's a small town, and small towns do embrace in their own ways, right? But with parents and heritage that comes from elsewhere, and what we're talking about tonight, which is the Indian Ocean Rim, how has that found its way into your creativity, whether it's into your creative process or into the ways that you have started to think about writing before you entered this mentorship program, if at all? And anyone can start.
So with myself, my mum is a writer. She's in the room. But she writes poetry, the most beautiful poetry in Indonesian and in Arabic, so I definitely feel like I've inherited the writing gene from her. But in terms of how it may colour my writing, my background and my faith, I'd say that when I write, I suppose I try to write within my values. So I would feel uncomfortable writing something that I felt sort of goes against my values, and that's values in terms of, like, I don't know, it's hard to say. With values, it's just this thing where I can't necessarily pinpoint that it comes from, you know, necessarily in the Indonesian culture or my Islam,
mm-hmm.
etc. But it's just this, with my upbringing, this sense of, oh, I'm not comfortable with this, or I'm comfortable with this, which sort of ties into, in that process when I was working on my piece with my mentor, that did come up where she suggested edits, and I'm like, oh, I just don't feel comfortable with this, and so ended up sort of coming to a middle ground about it. So I'd say, yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about your writing influences? So forget culture for a second,
yeah.
And just who do you read? Who is interested? Who have you always read as a kid growing up?
So I've always been a romantic, truthfully. So one of my all-time favorite authors is Jane Austen. I've read all of her books. I've read a couple at least once. So that's one. But also poetry is something I enjoy as well. But I really like the sort of old, the classics, like Elizabeth Barrett Browning,
okay.
Even Shakespeare, some of his poetry.
So really old school.
Yes. So I guess I like that sort of classic, romantic sort of time, I suppose.
You told a really interesting story when we were prepping for this conversation about reading Jane Austen in the park. Do you want to tell that story? Because I think it's
speaks
to some of what
definitely. There was one time back when I used to live in Whiteside Street, in Cloverdale. there was a park just behind our house, and it was a really beautiful day. And I thought, oh, you know, perfect day to get some reading done. So I literally brought my really fat, complete collection of Jane Austen with me to the park. And I was just sitting under a tree, just reading, minding my own business. And then I just sort of noticed, you know, from my peripheral vision that there was a figure, like there was no one else in the park, but there was a figure that was sort of moving closer. And I kind of looked up, and it was an elderly man. I didn't pay too much attention to him. I thought, oh, you know, it's a public park, so whatever. And I just kept reading. And then I noticed the figure growing larger, and I realized, I think he's heading towards me. So I started being a little bit nervous, but I thought, no, I'll just do what I need to do. And eventually I couldn't ignore him because he said, hello. So I looked up and I was like, oh, hey. And I thought, you know, I'll just be normal. Hey. He's like, oh, so what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I'm just reading a book. You know, I just thought, it's such a beautiful day. You know, just why not get some reading done? He's like, oh, so who are you reading? And so I told him, oh, Jane Austen, you know, one of my favorite authors. And in between, I could see that he was just, there was something going on in his head. He was just thinking really, something was going on over and over. And I was like, oh, okay. And I'm like sort of waiting for the point of this
conversation
interruption. He was like, oh, okay. And finally he says to me, so I'm actually part of Neighbourhood Watch. And it hit me what he thought, and I just started laughing and laughing. And I think I might even said, like, I wouldn't even hurt a fly. And then he said to me, oh, I feel really embarrassed now. And literally he was going red in the face. And to make up for it, he said, oh, you know, actually, I just live down the street. Can you see that house? You know, there's my wife, and you're welcome to visit, you know, us anytime. and he's like, oh, you know, you should come over for a drink. And he's like, oh, hang on. Oh, you don't drink, do you? So then I said, yes, I don't. So I was like, oh, cool. So he knows a little bit, maybe. And finally, he sort of scratched his head, and he's like, do you drink water?
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
And so I felt like when I heard that story, I thought to myself, well, that is kind of like the crux of it, isn't it? Like these very poignant, uncomfortable, difficult conversations. But what it comes down to is this, like, but do you drink water? Like, on some level, if you want to look at it in the most positive and beautiful light, you can be like, okay, every human drinks water. We've got common ground. And then if you want to look at it in like the worst possible light, you're like, but you have to check whether I do. You know? So just that fine line, that sort of tension is what I guess we, many of us, you know, walk in this city. Okay, so so I was asking about what we read. So Rochelle, what's your reading style? Who are you into?
So
and sorry, let me clarify. Who were you into before you started the mentorship? Because
right.
I think that's important for when we get to talk about the mentorship.
Yeah. So before the mentorship, I was reading a lot of I'll start from like when I was younger, so like 13 to 18 maybe.
Yeah.
That I was reading a lot of like science fiction, so things like 1984, Ender's Game, Battle Royale by Kushin Takami and stuff like that. So that was that period of my life. And then once I turned 18, I started reading, I guess more because I moved to Perth, things like books on like psychology and then also essays, because that's when I discovered like James Baldwin and bell hooks and stuff like that. So that's when my thoughts started turning a bit political and I started to think about things a bit more deeply. Sorry, I'm supposed to talk about the mentorship.
You can, yeah.
So
you have permission to talk about the mentorship.
And then since the mentorship, I've been reading a lot more. So Murakami is the style that Murakami writes in. I really love it. I don't love a lot of his stories sometimes, but just his prose, I think, is really beautiful. And Shuku Feiza,
we spoke about
Rashida's friend as well, and her book, The Enlightenment of the Green Gage Tree, is just amazing, and she's a Perth resident as well, and I think it's beautiful. I'm reading a lot of different things right now to try and figure out what I do like, because I spent a lot of time not reading like things like classics that I probably should have read when I was younger. So now I'm just sort of playing catch up with that.
Right.
Thing out.
Gotcha. Priya, can you talk a little bit about your reading taste, and then I want us to talk about the mentorship.
Yeah, sure. So I guess for me, my reading was sort of quite varied.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would sort of, when I was younger, you read everything from Harry Potter, Goosebumps, but it kind of, as you got older, it's just, I was quite sort of diverse in my tastes. I think one of the things that I sort of have noticed is that before sort of the mentorship, I wasn't reading a lot of poetry. And I think even when you sort of go, like if you go to a bookstore or something, the poetry section is probably like this big, and everything else is sort of just novels or sort of nonfiction.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of what I had read a lot more, you know, it would have just been self-help books or any of the new sort of, you know, or any new novels that are out at the moment. And I think as being part of the mentorship program, I think the most amazing thing that happened is being sort of exposed and sort of opened up to this whole new world of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So before that, you know, I just sort of read, you know, the big names like Rumi or Pablo Neruda, but now it's kind of, there are all these Australian contemporary poets, and then there are all these journals of poetry, and then there are classic poets as well. And I think for me, that has been probably like the most amazing thing of being in that mentorship, just being able to read so much more widely when it's probably not as, I don't think it's accessible, or it's more just, it's not, you're not exposed to it as readily as for maybe sort of other forms of writing.
So with reading, actually you reminded me, Priya, when I was in primary school, I literally read a book a day, and I think that probably is partly why got this passion for writing and story, and I read Goosebumps. I loved R.L. Stine. Like I read quite widely in terms of genre, but I think I later found that I just love stories of where my heart was, and I find that as I grow older, I tend to kind of find most enjoy love stories.
If you're carrying around the collected works, we're under no illusions about what it is that you
do. During the mentorship, Elizabeth did suggest like a couple of readings in terms of in the genre that I was writing in, which is creative nonfiction. So it's not something that I've really written in before. So she suggested some, like examples, which I found a lot easier to get my head around what it meant with creative nonfiction, being not a very common, I guess, genre. But also she mentioned one of her favourite authors, Sonia Hartnett.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, well, let me try reading one of her books, or rather actually listen to one of her books. I find these days, to be honest, I really struggle with
actual reading.
So I've been sort of dabbling with audiobooks, which I've been enjoying. But I just had this really, a funny experience of throughout my mentorship, something that I know I do as a writer is I'm very verbose. I describe something three different ways in the same.
Tell them about the pencil. I love them.
Yeah. So, for example, it's not in this particular piece, but in another piece. For example, I once described this pencil case of, you know, the color, the pattern, the fluffiness, and the person who was sort of editing my piece asked me, so what's the significance of the pencil case? You spent like a paragraph on it. And I was like, oh, it's just her pencil case. So that's the degree of how verbose I am. So so the feedback I've been getting is I need to start to pare back. And so Sonia Hartnett, she is very spare. So what was funny was I listened to an audiobook of Sonia Hartnett, and immediately after, I listened to an audiobook of Daniel Steele, and it was just like black and white. And what was funny was I was so used to Sonia Hartnett that when I was listening to Daniel Steele, I was getting frustrated. I was just like, just get it. So yeah, it was an interesting experience in terms of my development and
the work
and
the mentors are doing the Lord's work. So let's talk about the mentorship. How is it structured? Like, what happened? Describe the sort of late night when you decided to apply or whatever. And how that, like, take us from beginning to end, and any one of you can go and, yeah, just describe what the process of the mentorship was like from application till like now.
Do
you want
to go,
Rochelle? Yeah, sure. So I was at home one day and I was checking through my uni emails, and I got an email from my university tutor, Robert Wood, and it said...
The one and only.
The one and only at the back. And it said...
Actually, there's lots of Robert Wood.
I know! I've Googled you!
and it said, hey, Rochelle, I don't want to be too forward, and I don't want to ask you where you're from, but you seem like you might be interested in this if you're from the Indian Ocean region. And then he went on to say, my mother's is also De Cruz, who's a Medali as well, which is our ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
So I just figured...
Nepotism.
And he was like, applications have already closed, but just email and see what you can do.
See?
So, and I clicked on the application, and the closing date was like a month. But so I sent the email off to Caroline, and Caroline was like, cool, we'll send your stuff through and see what you can do. And then it took a couple of weeks, and then I got paired up with Rashida Murphy, my mentor. And then basically it was just like 4 months of just talking over coffee, talking in libraries, talking about my writing, getting me to write in the first place, because I did not really write before this mentorship, and getting me to write stories about myself and not being afraid to be myself, really, which is like a really important thing that has come up like a lot in mentorship.
Yeah, fantastic. For you, Priya, was it similar?
I think so. I actually did have the late night for the application. So I remember seeing the post for it, and I was like, oh yeah, I should apply. And then the Monday of the deadline, I hadn't actually written anything. And I was like, why didn't I do something? And so I remember on the train to work, I like just took my notebook and I'm like, let's just see what I can do. And so I wrote some poems, and on my lunch break, I wrote some more. Then I stayed back after work and just wrote, and I submitted my pieces at 11:59.
You could have taken another month.
Yeah, And then I remember when I found out, like, we had our first meeting, and like, I was talking to one of the other mentees, and he was like, oh, how many did you submit? And I said, oh, the thing said that we should submit up to, like, 8. He's like, oh, no, it's up to 8. You don't have to submit 8 poems. I was like, oh, my God. But, Robert is actually sort of my mentor. So I remember the first email that he sort of gave to me. So I didn't realize that Caroline was his mum. And so he emailed and he was saying to me, like, oh, I'm going back to the motherland. And so I get it, Robert Wood. I look at his web page and I'm like, okay, is he saying the motherland because I'm from India?
Oh, that's so hilarious. That's so good.
And obviously after that...
Double entendre.
Yeah.
Poetic.
With our actual sort of mentorship experience has been amazing. So I'm like actually quite sort of a disciplined person. Like I work as a lawyer and I wasn't writing as much before. So I think for me what I'd asked like Rob to do was to kind of be a bit more structured, and so we sort of would meet like fortnightly. I would have to submit poems to him beforehand, and these weren't just it wasn't really more to like go out to submit or anything. It was just more so that I would get into the practice of kind of writing a lot more regularly, and then he would sort of give me books to read and then swap them out, and then we'd do that over. And so it was really helpful. And at the start it was a lot more on like style, but towards the end just general like concerns about, I think you go through a process throughout the mentorship. Like, at the start you're like, oh wow, this is amazing, and then once you start to read more, it's kind of, you're like, oh my gosh, my work isn't that good. And you sort of go through all of that, and it's just so nice to have somebody there just to be able to sort of talk to and kind of bring you back. And
angst is part of the writing, part of the writing process. We all know it. How's the process been? What was it like for you?
So for myself, I've actually been coming to the Write Nights at Centre for Story. It's the first sort of writing group that I joined, and it's really kicked me off in my writing journey. And so it was through that group being here where I heard about the mentorship program. So I knew that I was going to apply, but I wasn't sure what I was going to apply with.
Mm.
And I decided actually to send a piece that I wrote about five or six years ago, which was a non-fiction piece of my first experience at a WAFL game.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd originally written the piece as a blog post for a photographer friend who wanted to start like a WAFL blog with photos and a bit of a story about the games, that sort of thing. But during the process of the mentorship, it completely changed. It's quite magical when I think about how my current piece came together.
Mm.
So basically in my initial meeting, my mentor Elizabeth, she had given me like an annotated document about my piece. But what we both agreed on that it really lacked was, some sort of message or some sort of theme that tied it. It was very scratch the surface, this was my experience. And so she gave me this exercise of basically word sort of association manipulation,
mm-hmm.
based on the title, which was called "This Skin in the Game."
Mm-hmm.
And so it was through that process of just playing with the words of skin in the game that I came to write these phrases. And one of them was gaming the skin, and something about that title, we both just really loved it, and we both agreed about basically writing a completely new piece but based on that idea.
Mm.
So that's sort of but as for the process, we met generally once every 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
because she tutors in writing, so both of us were pretty busy. It was about 4 or 5 months that we were essentially just working on that piece, and pretty much each time it was cutting. Mind you, there were bits where she said, there were parts where she was like, oh, perhaps expand on this bit, and I'd write another 1,000 words. So literally at one stage, I'm sure it was over 4,000 words,
right.
But I managed to pare it back to
describing
about 3.
A blade of grass.
So that's been a huge learning curve for me, is just learning when detail is important and when it's not, which I'm still learning. So, yeah.
I would love to hear some of your work. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. So, I decided to read the opening part of my piece. I was going to read actually the story in the park, but one of the things that Elizabeth said to me was try reading it aloud, and then that will give you a sense of, you know, which one you might want to go with more. So I thought, yeah, I'll start with this one. Gaming the Skin. It was almost 20 years ago when I walked down a long corridor, dull grey filling my vision. I was 16 years old at the time, arriving in Perth with my cousin, Gaptara. The sound of planes taking off and landing filled the air as we headed for the carousel area to claim our luggage and braced ourselves for the expected interrogations. We were migrants after all, with an invisible neon sign flashing above our heads that read, "Pick me for a random inspection." I adjusted the scarf that covered my head and looked at Kaptara, her shoulder length, silky black hair bouncing with each step. As our anxiety heightened at the sight of the uniformed officers and their critical eyes perusing open suitcases, a thought came to me. I said a few words to my cousin, who was 12 years my senior, and she nodded in agreement. "Do you have anything to declare?" a middle-aged woman asked, her skin the colour of privilege. We both envied her fair tones, only days earlier masking our own faces white with talcum powder for a festival in Banda Aceh. Although we would have appeared odd to Westerners with our ghostly faces, to our Indonesian relatives, we looked a shade more beautiful. Yeah? My cousin spoke slowly. I pressed my lips together. I didn't trust myself to speak, didn't trust the accent that would come out of my mouth. So selfishly, I let Kaptara do all the talking while I remained her mute companion. Nonetheless, to be helpful, I assisted her with unzipping our suitcases to unveil food and more food. "What's in this?" the woman asked, picking up a transparent packet of an Indonesian sweet, a fragile pastry in the shape of small scrolls, colloquially called love letters. Kaptara hesitated, her face scrunched in concentration. "What is in this?" she asked again, her pace slower, her tone a couple of decibels louder. "Flower?" Meanwhile, I clamped my lips tighter, glad she wasn't turning my way for help. A raised eyebrow. "Flower?" Kaptara nodded. "Yeah," she said. "Anything else?" Kaptara's eyes retreated into her mind. Sugar? She nodded. Egg? Another confused expression. Egg? Yeah, egg. Anything else? Kaptara shook her head. This process repeated for item after item that must have looked suspect. Finally, half an hour later, we survived the grilling and made our escape. It was only once we were out of earshot that the drumbeat in my chest slowed and I unclamped my mouth and laughed. "Oh my God, you were so convincing," I said in my perfect Australian accent. Kaptara, who had completed a PhD in the University of Western Australia, met my laughter with a chuckle of her own. "Yes, we're quite lucky," she said. In spite of the smile on my face, guilt trickled into the pit of my stomach because it was the first time I had bent the rules in the game of skin.
Thank you.
that's absolutely fantastic, the game of subversion and how interesting and powerful it can be to play with stereotypes. Yeah, and so the joke is on somebody else. Yeah. Priya, do you want to read some of your work?
Yeah, sure. So the poem that I'm reading first is called Wildflowers. Girl shifts in her dress, tugging at the invisible cords around her neck. Skin the colour of driftwood, and eyes like emeralds in a pool of black. Where are you from? They always ask. Here and everywhere, she always says. Her mother would wear wildflowers in her hair and run amongst the trees, chasing a storm that never came. Searching in the looks of strangers in whose eyes she could not belong. Girl was once kissed softly by a boy who smelt of the earth after it rained, whose breath would flow through her, whose touch would help take her pain. She tried to find her way within his folds, a home in his bones, though it never came. As if left abandoned, to lay on the sea floor, to drench in cold black darkness, with only the waves to offer her warmth. Until all that was left was a girl, with unbroken lips and a too wide stare, driftwood skin and emerald eyes. Where are you from? They would have asked. Here and nowhere, she would have said.
I think we need another one.
So this one is called Scattering. Scattering. Scattering like a tower of bricks falling to the earth. Momentarily suspended before impact. In the timeless space between here and now, where the borders have been scrubbed out. That is where you tore me. Tore me into pieces of the moon so that I could see my reflection. Imprinted in that instant, as the light shifted, to open what had been left there to forget. Each drop of time glistening in the air like tears falling from the clouds.
Thank you, Priya. Again, just this beautiful way of a real subtlety with where you're from, kind of infused without having to shout it aloud. It's gorgeous. Thank you. Rushin?
Yeah. Did I write this one?
Yeah.
Yes,
too.
I write fiction. The short story is called Vulture. And just like a bit of context, it's about a religious festival that the Gujarati people celebrate, the Jain religious group. It's called Navratri. I'm not a part of that religious group. My family and I are Christians. But it's about this time that I went there in 2017. Stepping through the gym doors is an immediate assault on the senses. Loud tablas bang away on stage and a skinny woman in a sari wails into a microphone. The smell of fresh chapatis and dal descends from the top of the stadium seats and floods the court. Navratri, Sonia had mentioned to me. To me, the word held no meaning. My father informed me that it was the stick festival, with a warning to be careful of any incantations or rituals that I may be dragged into. Isn't it beautiful? My uncle leans over my shoulder again. I guess. Eh? Chi! No appreciation for your own culture. He goes silent, but I know it won't be long before he throws his two cents in again. I scratch at my ankle. Sonia has joined her group of friends. Guys! This is Prakash. Prakash, these are the guys. She points around the circle. This is Rahil, Kusha, the twins. My attention drifts, and I give up trying to remember each of their names, shaking their hands and smiling politely instead. The gold and silver embroidery of their saris and kurtas beams bright under the stadium lights. Prakash, who did you bring? Kusha asks, peering over my shoulder, small face frozen in excitement. Oh, this is Uncle Vulture. I point to my shoulder. A pleasure to meet you all, he says, mouth curling into a smile. I'm just going to skip forward a little bit. Hey, Sonia whispers, wrapping her hand around my forearm. You okay? She looks at me with those eyes, round and brown, so dark they look like moonlit lakes you might accidentally slip into if you weren't careful. Those were the eyes that first caught me, hunched over a textbook in the empty library. She spun beautiful tapestries of a place she called home, friends and family gathering on hot summer nights, eating roti and gulab jam. As the elders retired to their reading room to sip on warm chai and talk family business, sons and daughters sculled bottles of beer and got tipsy of cheap wines and ciders. You have to come over someday, she said. My parents would love to meet you. We'd have such a good time. I never did go over. I had this dream for many nights. I belonged to a family, and we lounged and laughed and listened to stories of a distant home we longed for, though we would never go back. They held me and called me Beta. And every night, I was awakened by the hard tapping of a beak on my forehead. She comes back, Rahil now attached to her hip like a third arm holding a stick of incense. Carrying four dancing sticks, she hands two over to me. So it's like this. You have to go right, left, right, right, and then over. There's a flurry of instructions, most of which I miss, but eventually I get the hang of it. My arms are heavy and sluggish, but I won't make a fool of myself in front of these people. Hey, Sonia, I start, pointing to the left wall of the gym. Over there. Is that a man dressed as a bird or a bird dressed as a man? She follows my finger to a creature standing in a group of uncles, just as tall but with a curved black beak opening and shutting, yellow feathers protruding in a proud mohawk down his head. Upon close inspection, what would naturally be his arms gives way to white wing-arm hybrids, occasionally losing a feather which floats gently to the ground. She considers the question for a few seconds. I have no idea. Does it matter? I respond with a deliberate wondering if my uncle has anything to do with this. He's soaring high above the crowd, barreling through the air, perfectly in time with the drums. The black dress shirt sticks to my torso.
Fantastic. Playing with what they call magical realism, right? That real creating a characters who are so lifelike and so human-like and yet are this sort of interesting hybrid. So, fantastic. So I'm sure that people have other questions. I could go on and on. I have a few more. But I wanted to open up the floor now that you've had a little taste of what these guys can produce. So if you have any questions or comments or anything you want to probe a little bit further, please feel free to do so.
I was going to ask you, Rahil, how you fit in your writing with your medical studies.
So I've been on holiday for the last 4 months. But basically, yeah, I mean, even before this, I wasn't really writing. So I guess like one of the things that Rashida has really taught me to do is to just sit down and write every day, even if it's for like 20 minutes. And like that really helps. Like if I set a timer for 20 minutes, I'll get into the process of writing and eventually I'll write more and more. So I do that like just before I go to bed. I've got all sort of the ideas from the day, and then I just blurt out a piece of paper, and then stories will come out.
You're not distracted by video games or sport.
Yeah, no, not distracted. Never. Yeah, no.
Thank you. I saw a hand in the back. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to know when you are doing your creative process or creating whatever style you guys do. At what point do you know I'm happy with the work that I've produced and I don't want to work on it further, or maybe the path that I chose isn't where I thought it might be, but I think I'm going to stop it now if it's done or cooked or whatever?
Yeah.
For me, I find it's different if it's poetry compared to if it's a story. So with poetry, it's something I don't usually force. It's something that just comes to me and I'll it'll just spill out of me within hours sometimes even, or and so it's like there's a part where I'm inspired by the muse or whatever you call it, and I'll just write what's in my head, but it's still not complete, and I'll usually go through a process of playing around with the words, the structure, the order, and eventually it comes to a point where I'm happy with it, and then I'm essentially done. And even if I look back 10 years later and I do, and I read things I wrote in high school, and I'll cringe, but I still feel like it's done, in that it's meant to exist in that form, because it's capturing that, how that feeling, that moment. But with story, that, like short stories, like fiction and even non-fiction, I feel like I'm a bit more open when it comes to editing. So I've only just more recently started to put things out there, like submitting it to places. So, but it's more of, I get sick of it. So I stop working on it when I get sick of it. And then it's more that I rely on others to help me tell me, like, what else can I do with this? Because I actually just can't look at it anymore. Especially, like, I do get bored quite quickly, which is probably why I do a bit of everything. Like, I've written poetry, fiction, I'm working on a novel, and yeah, because I have I have the shiny object syndrome, as they say. So that's it. So.
Yeah, I think I definitely, like what sort of Ray was saying, where I started off writing my poetry like that as well. So it was really emotionally driven, kind of, you know, you had a bad day and you just sort of write it on a page, and it started off being sort of kind of a more like a stream of consciousness. It's just you write what you feel. However, like going through this process, I'm a lot more deliberate in sort of the way that I write, and sort of I think it's just sort of after reading more as well, I sort of will choose my words sort of quite carefully, and I'm sort of an oral person as well, so I will always read it out loud and sort of hear how it sounds to sort of get the words and you know, go through it in that way. And so now I do go through multiple edits, and I'll have to leave some works. Like, I have a lot at the moment that are unfinished poems. Like, I just can't sort of keep going, and I'll leave them for a while and I'll come back to it. Whereas, as opposed to when I started, it would have just been like, yeah, just, you know, your emotions on a page.
Perfect.
So,
yeah, it's kind of hard to, like, tell when something is done. I haven't looked at this in, like, 2 months, I think. And then I was reading it last week, and I was like, wow, I need to change this. But I already know that it's, like, it's out there. It's done. Like, it's finished. And I'm not going to change it now, because I'm just, like, not the person that I was when I wrote that. And that's completely fine. But, yeah, to be honest, it was just sort of the deadline for this program that, that this was done. I'm not going to die. So that's it, yeah.
Any other questions? Yes, way in the back.
Yeah. This might be a bit of a cliche question, but do you find that when you're writing, that it's inevitable that your cultural background does affect the things that you explore, or can you sort of at some point separate it when you want to write something maybe outside of what you've written before, or is it something that you always seem to come back to regardless of the medium that you choose to write in?
I'll answer this first, because with myself, I personally want to write just whatever I feel like writing, and if anything, I feel a resistance to write about my culture or my beliefs, just because even though it's a very important part of me. In fact, I remember the first novel, complete novel I wrote, actually wrote as part of this 30-day challenge. This was in 2017. And it was basically, the challenge was to write 50,000 words in 30 days. It's called the National Novel Writing Month. And when I actually caught up with someone, like another writer who writes poetry and was also writing a novel as well, and I was telling him about the idea I had for my novel, and I remember him saying to me, you know, Ray, you should write about a Muslim woman living in a Western society, trying to manage, you know, the Western culture, and because it would just be so fascinating, you know, to get in your head. And I just remember thinking, oh, but I don't like to write, I guess, to expectation. If anything, if I don't feel challenged, I get bored. So even with that book that I wrote, it's a story about a couple that are struggling in their relationship in two areas, communication and personal finances, which are two things that I am interested in and passionate about. But to make it harder for myself, I decided to write the book completely from the guy's point of view, because that was more challenging and thus more exciting and fun. So I guess with myself personally, it definitely probably will colour my work, but I don't like to write, I guess, to expectation, and just because I come from where I come from. So,
So for me, it's like, definitely I can separate it, and for a long time I did separate it. Like, one of the reasons I used to read sci-fi a lot was when I was a kid, was because, like, from the ages of like 10 to 13, I think, around that time, like, every night for dinner, my dad would, like, sit us down and we'd all watch Star Trek The Next Generation together. So, like, I have been brought up on sort of, like white media and white stories. And so, like, part of this process, especially at the very beginning, was Rashida sort of, like, ironing this out of me and being like, you're allowed to tell stories about your culture. You're allowed to be proud of who you are. You're allowed to be proud of, like, all of these things that I didn't know that I could stand behind before. And now I've got this, like, great mix where I can tell a story about an Indian festival where people are also turning into birds at the same time. So I think my work has definitely been enhanced for it. And I wouldn't go back. But, yeah, before, definitely, it was very separate, yeah.
I think for me it's probably a lot more unconscious. I don't sort of ever... I guess, write with that in mind. I think what I have been surprised with is how much it does sort of just unconsciously influence it. But because for me, you know, I guess, yeah, being Indian and having that culture is never, it's there, but it's just a part of me. So I don't fight it as much. Mm. And I don't sort of have, those are probably the issues that I am struggling with in my life or things like that. So I think for when it comes in, it's just because that's what I've been brought up with and those are the influences and that's what I've read, rather than sort of I'm trying to sort of figure out this identity with that.
That's the lovely thing about the creative process, that it's, you know, that diversity of responses is exactly right. There is no right or wrong answer or right or wrong way to be a writer of color or a white writer or whatever those terms mean. I think it's gorgeous that even in the responses you can hear that it very much comes from what each of you said about yourselves and how you grew up. It's very much infused in the choice of style that you've chosen to write with. Yes?
When did you know that you wanted to write?
When I got accepted.
I knew he was going to say that. I absolutely knew he was going to say that.
No, I'm sorry, but it was like, I was good at writing in school, and I enjoy words. Like, I enjoy rap, I enjoy words. I enjoy how words flow together and how they sound in my ear. But yeah, and then I sort of just forced myself to do English units at uni, because I was like, if I can write, then I probably should write. And so that's how I did a couple units, and that's how I met Robin and got into this whole thing. So really just when I was 20 years old, yeah. It's nothing.
I'd like to hear the response of all of you, but it links to a question I was going to ask anyway, so.
Yeah, I think for me, I did really enjoy writing. I'm a lawyer as well, so I'm always surrounded by words and writing, even just in my day-to-day. I think for me, I experimented with a lot of different forms before I actually landed with poetry. And sort of, you know, I initially was like, oh, maybe I'll start writing sort of articles or like opinion pieces, and I would try to do those, but they felt sort of too much like work.
Mm-hmm.
Then I actually started with short stories as well, and I thought, okay, maybe like I'll just experiment with these. And I think what I found was I actually don't like this. I didn't enjoy having that structure in place. And the way that I write poetry is that I don't really know where I'm going until I've started writing. And with poetry, it's like such a liberating form. It kind of, I start and you kind of go wherever the words take you. And I think for me, it's probably a lot more personal because in every other aspect of my life, it's quite structured. Like my work is quite structured, even to the culture, you have a family that's structured. And it's beautiful to have an outlet that is just free from boundaries.
But exactly.
I think it just develops though. So I would have only say that writing poetry specifically would have been just, I guess, because I used to write journals, so then sometimes they would, when I'd write in my journal, it would be poetry, but I didn't even really know it was poetry, you just wrote.
Just
came.
Yeah. So as a teenager.
Yeah.
For me, it's been since childhood, I've loved writing. I've written like poetry, very short stories that now have a name, flash fiction, like literally since primary school. I actually even remember, I think I was in year four when I'd written a poem for class and I'd given it to my teacher and I really love rhyming with poetry, although I do write poems that don't rhyme. And I remember my teacher actually saying, "Did you really write this?" because of the rhyme and the rhythm but writing's definitely something I've done since childhood. Again, probably the genes from my mum, I would say.
Any other question? So I wanted to ask quickly, what was the best thing about the mentorship process for each of you?
I think Robert Wood was the best part. I think it is amazing to sort of meet somebody like that who can just help you through the process. I think for me, it's to have somebody there who will sort of kind of, I guess, be your guide. Essentially, with writing, sometimes you just don't know where the first step is. And it can seem kind of, you just don't know where to begin. All of us have studied different things and, you know, you go through sort of school and even once you start work, there's like a process that you go through. You start off as a graduate or you're trained up and people kind of show you along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with writing, sometimes you feel like you're just dropped there and you don't know where to go.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's amazing to have somebody to sort of help sort of steer you a little bit and give you a little bit of direction. And I think even just the community, like sort of meeting like these guys or like the other mentees and having that peer group that you can just go to for support and guidance and just friendship and just ask, you know, oh yeah, I'm having a bit of trouble with this, which you probably can't go to other people as well.
So having that work of writers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you stole Robert. I was going to say Richard. You can still
say Robert.
But yeah, just being able to have that one-on-one interaction with someone who has been writing for so long and who writes for pleasure, because I didn't do that before, to know what that process is like and to know that stories don't come out fully formed, because that's something that I think holds a lot of people back from writing. I mean, like, it's interesting that you said that you didn't write short stories because you felt that they were structured. I don't write poetry because I feel it's too structured. and for me, short stories are... like, Rashida was just like, it's okay, when you first write your story, you don't know what's going on. Like, you're writing to figure it out yourself. That is your first draft. Like, this story originally was, like, about, like, the ethnic differences in India and LSD. Like, it wasn't... There were two separate pieces that eventually, just through our conversation, just happened to merge together into one. And, it's through the process of writing, it's through that creative process that you actually figure out what you're trying to say. Rashida told me that, like, 2 weeks ago. I was asking her about, like, something new that I'm working on, and she just like stopped me. She was just like, "You're overthinking it. You just need to write. It'll come to you eventually." And I was like, "That's simple enough." So, yeah.
Absolutely. It sounds like you've been in very good hands.
Yeah.
So what's one of the things that is very interesting to me about this process is that it doesn't assume that you are going to be a full-time writer and stop lawyering and stop being a doctor and just turn into a full-time writer. But I am curious about where in that continuum of that each of you are.
Yeah. So with myself, I One of my passions, I have many passions, which you'll learn if you follow me, but one of my passions is business or entrepreneurship. So it's always been in the back of my mind that I've really always wanted to start a business of some sort. And for years and years, I dabbled with a lot of things from event coordination to life coaching, but the thing I ignored was writing. So I guess in my mind, I thought to myself, well, let me set up a business and have that running, and now I can do my real love, which is writing. But what happened was a few years ago, I think it was end of 2017 actually, I discovered a podcast about self-published writers. And I started listening to these interviews of writers who were making a living, or like it was a huge range from writers who are still doing their job but starting to make money from their writing, to writers who are millionaires from writing. And it just opened my mind to the idea that writing could be a business. So I guess my personal aspiration is ultimately to work towards that. But yeah, it's just baby steps, obviously.
Tell me when you figure it out.
That's my
Priya.
I think for me, I think one of the best pieces of advice that Rob I think ever gave me was he was saying that it's just important to have a good life, and that poetry or writing is just part of that good life. And I think, you know, sometimes as I think as writers, you can sometimes feel like you're doing a disservice to your writing because you're not doing that full time and that you have another job. But I think when he was saying that, it's like, no, you can. There are this history, especially poets that who have had, you know, really normal day jobs, and then they still produce like these amazing pieces of work. And all of those other parts of your life, they don't sort of detract from your writing; they actually add to it. So I think for me, it's just kind of just like enjoying and just keeping going with it. Like, I am loving it so far, and for me, I think I want to sort of try to develop like a body of like publishable work as well. Like, you know, with poetry, you can write a lot of poems, but if I look back at the ones that I wrote 6 months ago, they're not, you know, things that I want to sort of send out into the world. But now it's sort of actually kind of developing those and being part of that community, because, you know, it's really nice to even sort of do things like this, so like being able to meet more people and sort of interact with that world. And I think to do that, you know, to engage in that community, you publish so that you can sort of be in that conversation.
I think, in terms of like the continuum where I am, like giving up my life for full-time writing, I'm very much at the very, very beginning where that's not even a possibility, because I'm still at the phase where I feel like I'm not confident enough in my own ability. And so every time I sit down to write, I still have that anxiety that's inside me that's just like, oh, this is going to be trash. And so...
It never goes away. Sorry.
But, so yeah, I'm still at the very beginning of this journey. We'll see how it goes. Yeah.
Fantastic. I think our time is up. So thank you all very much. It's impossible to summarize, but they were fantastic, and I think everyone agrees with me. I thought to end on this lovely note that Priya ended with, and this advice from Robert about writing as a good life, because it is the Writers Festival now, and you're all here because you're obviously interested in books. But I also think that I'm a mother, and so often when I think about my kids and their relationship to words and reading, I worry a lot. So this idea of a good life, and so much of what we've talked about tonight has been about a process that is slow, that is deliberate, that forces you to be outside of yourself, because in order to write well, you have to read. And that is ultimately aimed at self-improvement with rewards that are internal rather than externally driven. And I think that's quite lovely. So thank you all for embodying all of those things.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to more stories or to make a donation, head to centerforstories.com.